The following presentation is The City Club of Eugene, recorded on January 29, 2016, The Neglected Few, Students of Color and Their Experience on the University of Oregon Campus.
We host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs, and today is our 17th program in our 2015-2016 programming year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's host is Lisa Arkin, who will be introducing the speakers and the first questioner.
The title of today's program is The Neglected Few, Students of Color and Their Experience on the U of O Campus. Our guest speakers today are Perla Alvarez. She is the internal director of MECHA. She is a senior majoring in ethnic studies. Dante Haruna is our second speaker. He is from the Queer Trans People of Color Union, and he is majoring in music with a focus on the vocal arts. Our third speaker is Shanice Curry. She is with the Black Women of Achievement and the U of O Black Student Task Force. She's a double major, both in planning and public policy, as well as ethnic studies with a focus on public health. Our fourth speaker is Gerald Jakubowski. He's the co-director of the Asian Pacific American Student Union. He's a junior majoring in economics, and he is also a member of the Collegiate Christian Fellowship Leadership Team. Our first questioner today will be Dr. Charles Martinez. Dr. Martinez is the department head and professor of educational methodology, policy, and leadership in the U of O College of Education. I also wish to give special thanks to Samara Mokaya, the community outreach coordinator with the U of O Multicultural Center, and Joel Eboa, the environmental justice community outreach manager with Beyond Toxics, who were instrumental in helping to organize today's program. This panel of University of Oregon undergraduate student leaders represents diverse organizations dedicated to supporting students of color on campus. The four student representatives will discuss how being members of a minority group can impact their ability to learn and grow on the university campus. Thank you for being here, speakers.
Thank you. So, hi, everyone. I will be the first one speaking. My name is Perla Alvarez, and my pronouns are she, her, hers. So please use those pronouns whenever referring to myself. I want to start us off by doing an activity. We're going to do the Unity Club. I will explain why that is. In MECHA, that's how we start and end our meetings. So I hope you can join me. We are going to start clapping, and we're going to clap to the rhythm of our hearts. So first, slow, and then we're going to speed it up, and then it's going to end very rapid. Okay, so we're going to start. Okay, so the Unity Clap was used during the whole United Farm Workers movement back in the 60s, and it was a form of communication between the farm workers, the Filipino farm workers, and also Latino Mexicanos farm workers, and it stands for one down, one fall, and it is a way to show the people power and the unity between the oppressed groups. So this is, again, a way to teach and pass down the knowledge of all those people who fought in the 60s so we could all attend to school and have the rights that we have now. Again, my name is Perla Alvarez, and I am a third-year student at the University of Oregon, studying ethnic studies, and I have two minors. One of them is planning public policy and management, and the other one is Spanish. I am an immigrant. I immigrated from Mexico in 2006, and I am a first-generation student. That means that I will be the first one in my family to graduate from college, hopefully next year. I am the internal director of the Movimiento Estudiantil Chicanao de Aztlán, or MECHA, which is one of the Latin organizations on campus. And is one of two, actually, Latino student organizations on campus. It is primarily for those who identify as Chicanos, but I know a lot of our students do not identify as Chicanos. So there is a lot of Mexican-American students in our community, in MECHA, and leaving out a lot of other Latino students on campus. So that's that. MECHA has been on campus for over 50 years. We just celebrated our 50th anniversary 2 years ago. We focus on community building and advocacy and teaching our younger generations about higher education because we believe that education is very powerful. They can take away your rights, but they cannot take our education. This year, our membership in MECHA has doubled from the last year. We have about 60 to 70 active members, and it is a very hard group to manage. We have never had this many members before, and this shows that the Latino population is growing in Oregon and in the United States. We try to educate our students on issues that we usually don't learn in institutions, in the university. We teach them about ethnic studies. We teach them about political issues, current political issues that are going on not only with the Latino community, but also with other communities of color on campus and nationally and even internationally. We also teach them about, of course, the Chicano movement and indigenous roots. It's also very important for us to learn about where we come from and learn about colonialism and all these theories. That, again, we usually do not learn in the core curriculum in elementary school, in kindergarten, in high school, even at the university. If a lot of our students are not taking ethnic studies courses, so they have a vague understanding about how oppression works, how, like all the different movements, our own history. The MECHA has two very powerful programs. One of them is the Raza Unida Youth Conference. It happens every year, and we bring about 500 students to campus to experience higher education and to learn about the admission process and what it takes to attend a university. The students we bring are Chicano Latino identified, and we do have a budget for that, but it's not enough. So we have to fundraise to always have the conference happen. We do have some support from the multicultural person at the Office of the Dean of Students, but this person is overworked. This person not only supports MECHA, but supports all the students' organizations on campus. This person attends a lot of our meetings, and it's just very stressful for them. The Raza Unida Youth Conference is very important to us because, like I mentioned, one of the MECHA's mission is to teach our younger generations about education and the power of education and the power of giving back to our communities and being having representation in bodies where decisions are made. So, we can give back to our community. We also have the Ganas program, and that's where we go to Kelly Middle School, and this program has about 30 students. We go every Monday and Wednesday to mentor and tutor these students. We also bring them about 3 to 5 times a year to the University of Oregon, so they can also have exposure to the campus, to higher education, and just to more mentorships. A lot of our students have expressed that the students at the University of Oregon are like older brothers and sisters to them. We also serve as support to them because we know that a lot of their parents work for long periods of time, and they don't have time to, like, you know, like, they don't have a lot of time for their students and help them with homework, so that's what we're there for. We help them with homework. We also teach them about Chicano and Latino movements and other movements, bring ethnic studies to their knowledge. So why am I mentioning these two programs? It is mentioning that we as machistas, as students, we're doing the job of the institution. We are spreading, we are recruiting Latino and Chicano students to campus. We're bringing them, we're teaching them about what it takes to come to the University of Oregon or even higher ed. And it is not our job. That is why the admissions office is there for, or other offices on campus there are for. And don't get me wrong, we love doing it. We love going out there and teaching our young people about the struggles that we've been through, the struggle of, like, filling out FAFSA and not knowing what some of the terms there mean and having to go ask for help on how to fill it out. A lot of our students are also undocumented, and they don't know, or their parents are undocumented, and they don't know that they can't get financial aid. So we try to break those barriers for the students. We do get a stipend from the ASU, or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon, within our budget, but it's only $55 a month. And we usually do more than that. We work more than that, putting these conferences on, going to the Kelly Middle School, transportation. All of that money comes from our budget. We did have, used to have a graduate student position that was actually paid by, I think, the Office of Equity and Inclusion, but then that support discontinued. We don't have any support for the GANAS program or the RUIC, and we would like to continue being there for the students, for our younger students, so they can, you know, have access to higher education. And we can't do it all alone, you know. It's like another job, but we're only getting paid $50 a month. It's not enough. And so one of my recommendations would be more support for Mecha or students. Seeing, you know, reaching out to us, we tried, you know, reaching out to administration and asking them for, you know, more support, institutional support from them, especially funding. So yeah, that's that. And I have a lot of other demands. We've had these conversations in Mecha. They would like to see more translators during introduction at the University of Oregon. A lot of our parents just drop us off during introduction, getting introduced to the University of Oregon, you know, that orientation program that happens during the summer. And our parents just drop us off and they go home and they have no idea, you know, what goes around at the U of O. We're going to be safe. You know, how this is going to be our new home for a lot of us. And, you know, they don't know. They've never been through the university before, the system before. So, machistas, Latinos, we would really like to see Latino caucus spaces at the University of Oregon, where admissions people, hopefully, they could, like, break down the language, like, the financial language, and just speaking with our parents, telling us that we're going to be safe, that we do have support, that, you know, things that Latino parents don't know. So that's my little speech for today. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Okay, hello, everyone. My name is Dante Haruna. I'm a fifth-year senior at the U of O, music major. I'm about to graduate this year. I'm really excited and really nervous. and I'm here representing QDPOC, which is the Queer Trans People of Color Student Union on the U of O. For anybody that's not quite aware or sure of what the word queer stands for, I'm sure y'all have probably heard it, but so more recently, queer has been a word that the LGBTQ community has reclaimed. It definitely in the past has meant things that are odd, of course, is one definition, or has been used as an insult. But in the contemporary world, it's been reclaimed as a word to kind of describe an umbrella of ideas of different sexualities and genders, particularly those that fall outside of the norm. So like when we talk about sexuality, I think often we think about gay or straight, this very like binary model. Or when we talk about gender, we think of men and women or males and females. But there's a lot of folks who do not fit within those two ideas, or maybe fit in between or fit out or some combination of different things. So just for example, when it comes to sexuality, there's people can identify as bisexual, they can identify as asexual, which is not experiencing sexual attraction, they can identify as pansexual, which would mean being attracted to many different genders, not just men and women, but transgender folks, gender nonconforming folks. And when it comes to gender, people can be third gender, people can be agender. Agender would be not feeling like you have a gender. And people can be gender fluid or gender queer. And really all this is to say is that gender is how you present yourself to the world and how the world might perceive you. But ultimately it's coming from an internal place of how you feel in your body and how you want to present that body. So anyway, that's just a little like terminology. I first wanted to, my name is Dante, my pronouns are he, him, and his, and they, them, theirs. And I first want to go into just a little bit about CutiePoc as a group, a little bit about its history. So CutiePoc was formed in 2011, so very recently, and it was done informally from a group of students who identify as queer, trans, people of color. Basically, the main reason that they formed that group was because in the queer spaces that existed on campus, that still exist on campus, they didn't feel safe, they didn't feel comfortable, they didn't feel like their voices and concerns were being explicitly heard and met. And those resources that I'm talking about are the LGBTQIA, which is the student union, and the LGBTESSP, which is more like the department professional staff component to the QA. It was formed in 2011. Students felt like they needed a space where they could be both queer and trans and people of color and have that specific support. It was really informal. It was a very small group, and it's been a very small group of a handful of students, and it's mostly been a space for people to just decompress and really just hang out, and the importance of having that space to just kind of be together and hang out, so to speak, was vital for students to feel like they could validate each other and that their experiences, that they weren't alone. As of right now, this year, the group is not together. There's members, but they've all graduated. The group was officially recognized by the ASUO in 2015, and they have a budget, but again, there's not many students that are around. The ones that formed it have graduated, and the ones that are here are kind of scattered into different groups. So, for example, I identify as queer and Asian American. I'm a part of the Multicultural Center. And in my opinion, the Multicultural Center does a good job of creating that space. But the QA, the LGBTQA, for example, is mostly white dominated. So it's a space where personally, like when I go in there, I don't feel comfortable to like talk about POC issues because sometimes I think it's disregarded. People tend to want to focus on their issues as white, queer, and trans students, which is needed. Absolutely, that's needed. But POC students also need their own space. And there are CutiSoc students, queer trans students of color, in various other groups or non-groups just floating around the U of O. So we're here, is what I'm trying to say. But we need a lot more support in order to feel safe and comfortable in pursuing our educations and our careers and whatnot. So with that in mind, CutiePoc is not currently in function right now. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we don't have support. But first, I kind of just want to like share with y'all like my personal life experiences and journey, just to give you that framework, and then I'll go into demands at the end. But I was born and raised in Oregon. I grew up in Medford, Oregon for about half of my life, and then I moved to the coast of Oregon, Bandon, which is a small 3,000 people town. And so that was where I did most of my education. And my experiences growing up in Oregon have been very, very difficult. To be honest, like I'm still kind of coming to terms with a lot of the stuff that I internalized. But for example, growing up in school, being both queer, not being exactly sure what my gender identity was, and really just wanting to explore that, there was like a threshold of time where it was okay for me to, you know, dress like a girl or act like a girl or do these things that was just thought of as like, oh, that's just a boy being a little kid kind of a thing. That was what people kind of, the message people gave me. But I never viewed it that way. I just viewed it as like, my mom has a cabinet of videos and I happen to like the Disney ones and the princesses looked cool. And, you know, I wanted to wear scarves and sing and dance, which I still do. So, but it wasn't a matter of, like, trying to, like, be anything or not be anything. It just was what I gravitated to. And then there came a point where it became very clear to me that other students in my school, that other parents and teachers around me started telling me that I needed to act like a boy and what that meant. And I never understood why that was a thing. Like, it didn't make sense to me why I was being told that because I knew what I wanted to do. I didn't know what gender was. But so I, for my personal sake, like, I conformed to that. And at the same time, I also started facing a lot of the racism, a lot of the racist comments and microaggressions that, in my opinion, occurs very heavily in Oregon as well as in this country. And I think a lot of the times those comments aren't done with bad intentions. I think a lot of it's just ignorance. I think a lot of it's just people, that's kind of like the what our culture produces in terms of media, in terms of things that we carry from our parents and in our previous communities and that we teach to our kids. But for example, like especially in high school is probably the hardest time. I had to navigate, and this is where intersectionality comes in, and that just means like being queer and something else, or being Asian American and something else, for example. I had to navigate all those different identities because, for example, if I'm sitting in class and I happen to cross my legs under my desk, then people would be like, oh, you're being really gay. So I couldn't cross my legs. And then if I, like, raise my hand to answer a question, then people are like, oh, you're really smart, you're really Asian kind of a thing. So then I didn't want to, like, answer the teacher because I didn't want to be too Asian. But then people thought of me as, but then teachers would give me pressure and say, like, I know you can do better, why aren't you participating? It's like, I don't feel safe to participate. I don't want to raise my hand, I don't want to be here. And so a lot of my high school experience, to be honest, was me just kind of zoning out throughout the entire day so I could just get home and shut my door to the world when I got home, which is what I did. I lived most of my life after school just in my room. And so it didn't feel safe. I didn't connect with my education. I didn't really connect with my peers. That's not to say there weren't good things. Like, there were good things. But, and I came to the U of O, and it's just been this ongoing, I'm still going through it right now, this process of deconstructing that internalized stuff that I, for 22 years of my life, pitted against myself, these messages that I was being given, and thinking things were my fault. And that really, really inhibited my ability to focus. It inhibited my ability to care to understand why what I was learning was something that I could understand and take for my own and do something with that. School has always just kind of been this place where I get through to get my degree and then get out. And so what that brings me to is I think the importance of supporting QDSOC students, again, queer trans student of color, students of color, because we need to feel safe. We need to feel like we can see ourselves in positions of power to know that we can get far. So again, for example, I'm a music major, and the music school here is very white dominated. And I was actually thinking about this yesterday, but in my voice studio class, you know, it's like all our voice students of a teacher gets together and we sing for each other once a week. So there's this freshman student, and she's a young white female identified person, and you know, it's week four of the term, and I noticed when she was singing, like, just how amazing her technique had improved, how much her technique had improved. And, you know, I kind of projected onto the future. I was just imagining, like, her going through the next 3 or 4 years of schooling, and she has a lot of white female students that are on the stage in the school performing, being amazing, being fabulous opera singers. She has a lot of strong white female teachers. Not just within the school, and not just within the state or the country, but within the opera world and within the classical world, within the musical world. And absolutely that's necessary for folks who identify as women to have that representation. But for people who are either not white and or are not gender conforming or conforming to what society expects, it's really hard to have energy and to have care. I think I wonder what it would have been like if I had a queer Asian American teacher, if I had other queer Asian Americans on the stage, even within pop music, which is what I like, and I don't see them. You know, so it's in a lot of ways it feels isolating, it feels really alone. And it's hard to know that I can do something, even though, like, intellectually, it's like, yes, I can. Like, I know that's possible. But in terms of spirit and emotion, it's a whole different battle. So I'm talking a lot about myself. I want to get into my demands. I'm just trying to give you a personal example. So the demands I'm about to kind of suggest is a collection of ideas that I've come up with and that I've also come up with my peers who identify as Cutie Sock. These are current students who have their own personal experiences at the U of O. But one of the main things, just like the big picture, is just to have a physical space where we can go that is specific to our needs. We need mental health counselors who we feel like we can go to and specifically talk about our issues. Again, for example, I have a white male counselor who's really great. He's helped me out with a lot of stuff, but I don't feel comfortable talking about race because I brought it up and I can tell he's uncomfortable. And so I don't engage in that conversation. And that's a huge component of my mental health right now. At the same time, that kind of thing is similar for a lot of students, queer POC. When it comes to advisors, academic advisors, asking for help, connecting with their teachers, not just about the material, but also what's it going to be like for me to try to have a career in this field as my identity, considering the fact that we live in this society where I don't really see my identity, and my identity tends to just be kind of ignored and pushed to the side. I think we also need a queer resource center. PSU has one. I think OSU has one. They have meeting spaces, lounge spaces, libraries, computer labs. They have staff and faculty. They have advisors. They have mentors. And really all I'm just trying to say is that they have a support group, a network, a place to go, a building, a space, where they know that they can go to someone and talk about just like the quote-unquote normal things of like, I need a job, I need to go to school, I need to do this. But they know that they can trust that there's a person who has that deeper, specific context of being queer and trans and POC. And so there's a lot more demands. Cultural competency. So I think having teachers who, in my opinion, it's not just enough to have teachers, and this is what they've done, is to just have teachers kind of sit down at the beginning of the year and go through like a couple hour long course on how to be culturally competent, because on the one hand, like, I think it takes a lot more work to get things intellectually, because there's a lot of stuff in all of this that needs to be hashed out, but there's also a huge emotional component, and I think when that emotional component is missing, it's easy to kind of forget that queer trans people of color are in existence and that they need help. So intentionally hiring teachers and faculty that can understand that framework, specifically intentionally hiring queer and trans people of color in positions as administrators, as faculty members, as instructors, as GTFs, so that students know that they can go to someone to have those conversations and to voice those concerns on top of how do I get a career, how do I navigate life, how do I get a job, how do I, you know, pay my bill or whatever it might be. I don't know how much time I have. And also to focus on getting those people into the ESSP, again, the LGBTQ ESSP, which is the administrative portion of the queer resource on campus, having a space for students to come in, so, and having advisors and mentors and student interns that they know they can come to and talk to and say, hey, like, I'm struggling right now as a queer POC, queer and trans POC, because this happened. And just to have that validation it makes a huge difference. I guess I'll just end with saying that, you know, queer and trans people of color and students of color are out there right now, sitting in the classroom right now, being taught whatever they're being taught, and they're going through a lot of these things, and I think there continues to be a lack of representation within our society for those people. And for me personally, like, as I try to navigate and go forward and gain my own empowerment, I try to think of ways of how can I not forget those people that maybe aren't at that place or don't have that. And so I think from you all, what would be extremely helpful I think it's one thing to have conversations like this, and I'm very grateful that we have this conversation. And I think more needs to be done, too. I think these conversations need to continue to happen, not just happen once, because this stuff is not going away. We're not going away. We've been here since day one of humanity, and we're going to be here since the end of humanity. And so I think for you, I know that's kind of like philosophical and cheesy, but that's who I am. So if we can just focus on putting pressure on administrators, pressure in the sense of just having those conversations, demanding that we continue to meet like this, demanding that we continue to form committees with you all as supporters and donors and people who have power to be able to influence those in power at the U of O to create spaces, to create resources, to channel funds into queer and trans student color, because it's not just about serving a smaller population on the U of O campus, it's about changing our entire culture of our entire nation. Fun fact, 52% of the 0 to 5-year-olds in the U.S. right now are people of color, so things are changing, and we need your support. Our young generation needs your support. So please donate. Please demand that we have committees. Please demand that we continue these conversations and do action. And when we all call for y'all's help, please show up and support us.
Hello, everyone, and thank you all for having me. My name is Shanice Curry. I'm a senior at the University of Oregon. I'm a double major in 3PM in ethnic studies, and my focus is public health. I was born in North Portland, and I'm a first-generation college student. I currently serve as the director of the Black Women of Achievement, and I'm also a leader on the Black Student Task Force. My involvement with these student organizations started as a response to me seeking community out on campus. Instead, I was actually met with the lack of support and anti-Black racism. So anti-Black racism is something that has been permeating our campus since 1917. And that's when the UO admitted its first Black student, Mabel Bird. Mabel Bird was forced to work as a domestic worker in the home of a professor because she was forbidden to live on the campus and also in the community. This is one of the legacies of Matthew Deedy, one of the people that we honor as the father of our institution here. Somehow we excuse his explicit support of exclusionary laws that banned Black citizens from entering the state of Oregon up until 1926. We excuse the fact that Friendly Hall is still has two separate entrances to accommodate white students from Bobby Robinson and Charles Williams. They were two Black athletes at the University of Oregon. We excuse the fact that in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement, as churches are being terrorized, and as young Black college-age students are being murdered at unprecedented rates, we still do not have a safe place to congregate here on our campus. Today, the university states that we value our diversity and seek to foster equity and inclusion in a welcoming, safe, and respectable community. As a student of color, and furthermore as a Black woman, I understand that to not be true. The university's commitment to diversity is insincere propaganda. We put images of Black students next to Asian students and Latinos and sell a concept that we ourselves do not believe in, that we're not invested in. Diversity here on our campus has always rejected the incorporation of Black students, and it's time that as a community we address this matter. Black students currently represent only 2% of our student population, while Hispanics and Latinos are projected to rise to 10% in fall 2016. Asian students are 6%, and even what the UO classifies as non-resident aliens make up 11% of our student body. Black students still remain to be 2%. There are currently 3,274 international students on our campus and 472 Black students. What excuses we have as an institution? The demographics in Oregon, finding college-ready Black youth. But the problem with these excuses is, if that is the case, how is it that we have an overrepresentation of Black students on our sports team, but an underrepresentation in our classrooms? Thursday, November 12th, the Black Women of Achievement organized a march of over 500 participants, led by allies and myself. The march was to stand in solidarity with students at Mizzou, and it was also organized as an opportunity to raise awareness of the unique experience of Black students here on our campus. We later formed the Black Student Task Force to advocate for the needs of those particular Black students. Our work thus far has consisted of making visible the administration's previous and current shortcomings, publishing a list of demands, and engaging Black students in community building and forms of empowerment, something that has historically not been offered at our university. Our demands were released in November 17, 2015, and adequate momentum has not been made. Our demands are fairly similar to the demands that were published by the BSU in 1968, only 2 years after they created the organization. It's shameful. And equally disgraceful is the university's capitalizing of Black bodies while simultaneously dispelling them. We can no longer stand for it, and we will continue to increase lacking institutional support for Black students on our campus. Racial and social justice is not simply more Black representation. It's shared power and equitable resources. We need reconstructive justice in which we reform the foundation of our institution to sincerely incorporate Black students into its mission and reject the history of the lasting implications of anti-Black racism on our campus and on our state and within our state. We recognize that our demands are not zero sum, they are positive sum, in which they create a win-win situation for the university, and it's vital for the safety and success of our Black students that they are met immediately. If the university does not implement our demands, which could be found on the demands.org alongside other institutions, we will continue to mobilize, and we have. My recommendation for you all today is that you review our demands. As I said, they're on the demands.org, and we also have them published on our personal website. And pledge your support by contacting UO administration and the Board of Trustees and letting them know that we need more Black representation and that we also need support for our Black organizations. So we just hold them accountable to their mission and understand that Black students at our university are indispensable. And to really be committed to diversity and to really be committed to an environment that welcomes all communities and promotes safety and cultural development, we have to incorporate Black students, and historically we have not. So thank you.
Hello, my name is Gerald Jacobowski. I commonly go by G, just like the letter. I'm the co-director of the Asian Pacific and American Student Union at the University of Oregon, and I'm also on the leadership team of the Collegiate Christian Fellowship. I believe that my identity as a Pacific Islander and my faith in Christ have played such a developmental role in my development over the last 4 years that they play such a big impact that I deserve to talk about both of them. Quick summary on what APAZU is and where it came from is we were founded in the early 1970s under a different name, but we emerged from a time where there was a demand for ethics studies program because beforehand there were no ethics studies programs at the universities. So a coalition of people of color came together, and these people, what they wanted to do is they had the mission statement and the values to have their voices heard, break chains of injustice, and provide an authentic perspective on their view of life in the U.S. The Eugene community that emerged from this time is known as the Pacific and Asian Community Alliance, also known as PACA. APAZU shares the same mission statement and values as PACA, but we are more university-based, so we deal with students. What we do is we've created, molded, and we shaped social justice advocates and supported other marginalized communities through going through conferences, standing in solidarity with them. And what we currently do is we currently educate students by providing a space for them to get in touch with not only their roots, but also by creating awareness on the injustices that they have faced and that they will continue to face through their time. I think an important thing that I want to highlight that my staff, what we do is in APAZU, is we focus on not only educating others on social justice with the intellectual realm, but we also focus on changing the heart. Because in my opinion, the heart and the mind, they're connected. So you gotta have to have a change in heart to change your mind, the way you think, to change your actions. And so an example of that, to sum it up, is it's not enough to know what the right thing is to do, but you have to be willing to understand why it is the right thing to do, and you have to be willing to be bold to live that out in your life. So an example would be a lot of times Asian American Pacific Islander students get the question, where are you from? And then we'll answer. And again, we'll get the question back, no, but where are you really from? And what that, as frustrating as that is, what that demonstrates is that because the way that I look, the color of my skin, that person has a bias that thinks that I don't belong in the U.S., I'm not a true American, and that I'm from elsewhere. And that can be really frustrating. But APS, what we seek to do is we aim to transfer the person's thinking to, instead of recognizing that, yeah, that is bias and discrimination, is that the transfer for them to no longer think about it as not to say that because what their peers will think about them, but to transfer that into something where that they realize when I say those things and I reduce a person to a basic stereotype, that I'm harming that person. So what we do is we create social justice advocates that are not only able to speak within the Asian American Pacific Islander community, but we also take the extra step in creating leadership roles where our community is able to influence others in other communities. Which, there's a famous quote that goes, it's not the oppressed's job to educate the oppressors, but because we believe social justice is something that needs to be focused on now, we actually take up the mantle to do that. Just by some personal experiences that have happened at the UVO, both as an AAPIA and as a Christian, you hear a lot of microaggressions. For example, people will be like, man, your English is great. And a lot of times we'll be like, yeah, it is great because it is my native language. Thank you very much. You hear in classrooms, especially in science classrooms, do you really, like you'll get mocking, do you really expect prayer to do anything? Or if you have a belief in a one true absolute, truth absolute, like you don't belong in my classroom. And what that does is that creates a barrier between the student and education. And it creates a community that right off the bat doesn't feel inclusive and actually feels unwelcoming and alienates that student. So my question is, if UO faculty is supposed to support their purposes, visions, values, and mission statements of the University of Oregon, why are people feeling this way in these communities? And why are we feeling unwelcome? So my request to the UO admin is that they need to reevaluate what their teaching criteria is. It's no longer suitable enough to just hire based on what your teaching credentials are and what you've done in the past, but there needs to be an extra aspect where potential candidates are evaluated on their knowledge of social justice or having the passion to continue learning social justice and eventually become a mentor to students. What this looks like is I think there's five categories that should be evaluated on. It's character, chemistry, competency, culture, and calling. A potential candidate should have the character to uphold the UO values and mission statements. Potential candidate should also have chemistry, that professors in one department should blend well with professors in another department and be able to focus on carrying out that social justice aspect in their curriculum. Third, competency. Not only should the professor have the ability to teach in whatever field of study that they're teaching in, but they should have the competency of knowing what it means to have privileges, what it's like that what people struggle through, what it's like to have intersectionality and recognize that there are privileges given by some identities, and in some identities you don't receive those privileges. Fourth is culture. If the UO wants to maintain a culture of inclusive and safety, these potential candidates should also fit that culture. And lastly, they should have a calling. We shouldn't be hiring professors who are there because they want to look like they want to work at the UVO. They're there for the money. What we need is professors who want to educate students, who want to be mentors, and who want to continue pushing the social justice conversation. And so we recognize that this takes time. And even though it's needed now, we do recognize it takes time. And we recognize that, yeah, the UO is a multi-billion-dollar company, and that comes with, I'm sure, a bunch of issues. I've never managed a multi-billion-dollar company, so I wouldn't know. But my point is if your value at the UVO states that we value our diversity and seek to foster equity and inclusion in a welcoming and safe and respectful community, that value should be upheld no matter what the resources are going to take. And so the reason I believe that this would work is because it's no surprise that first-year professors have great influence on students. The thing with first-year professors is that they shape what first-year students perceive their education is to be over the next 4 years. So if a first-year student walks in and thinks that over the course of the next few weeks, or so the next few years at their school, that the only scientists there are white males, they're going to be conditioned by their environment to believe that's the truth. However, if you have a professor that understands that there's scientists that have contributed from multiple backgrounds, beliefs, you actually educate that person as a whole in a much more positive way, and also continue to educate them on these social justice issues. So in my closing remarks, yeah, I am proud to be a Duck, and I'm proud at the University of Oregon, and I do think it's a top-tier school. However, this is also the same reason why I hold it to such a high standard, because I believe that these changes matter, because the people matter, the issues matter, and change must occur. And I believe that if we do work together and we continue to tackle these issues, just like in Amos 5:24 it reads, justice will roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. Thank you.
I'm going to stand over here so that the speaker is not blocking my head. My name is Charles Martinez. As Lisa indicated, I'm a professor and department head in the College of Education at the University of Oregon. I'm also the director of a research center at the university, the Center for Equity Promotion. And probably important in part for this conversation, I served for 7 years as the vice president for institutional equity at the University of Oregon from 2005 to 2011. And I first want to acknowledge the courage of students to share their voices this way. So first, let's give them another round of applause. I will tell you that in my experience, this kind of forum is dangerous. And is dangerous in part because we in the audience have the potential to simply have the student voice in this context sort of be on display for us, like it's an exhibit for us to attend to maybe feel a moment of pain or shed a tear or feel a connection and then sort of move on in our lives. And that is a disservice to this voice. And behind this voice should be a sense of urgency that often is not in this conversation, but I feel it when I hear them. Because this voice, and you heard it in their comments, has been the voice with us, with this institution, since its founding. So what does it mean for us to sit here patiently listening to it without any sense of urgency? So to honor that voice, what I would encourage all of us to do in the audience is to feel some urgency, that the courage it takes to share their uncensored views with this audience is not just a call to listen, it's a call to action. So I want to make sure I say that out loud. The University of Oregon is a microcosm. So as we're sitting here in a broader community conversation, we might be thinking, oh, that's what's happening at the university. But this is Oregon. This is Eugene. And what students experience on our campus is very much like what people of color experience in a broader context. So that makes it on all of us to act. This is not a University of Oregon only issue. It is a community issue. And the kinds of experiences I've dealt with at the University of Oregon often have reflected a set of broader structural problems that reflect on us as a state and us as a broader community. And that's part of that call to action. We have to feel this urgency in our response to these students. And what I would like to ask of us and of our students as the first question is in framing this as a community issue, we can look at demands that are likely to impact the structure over the long term. And I think those are critical. And the kinds of demands that have been put forward by students here, and if you go on demands.org and read those demands, are very important for moving the institution forward. But the pace of change in the institution is really slow. In fact, you could make the case that an institution like higher education kind of depends on the slowness because, you know, these students will be gone in 4 or 5 years, right? So the pace of change in the institution tends to be slow. So urgency requires us to act in a more immediate way. And so as you, as our panelists, frame their demands in the form of what our community can do to help to respond to the kind of urgency that these voices reflect, what can we do as a community that will make a difference now? Because the pain is real. And it's sort of like going to a doctor's office with an acute injury and having them stare at the injury and say, that looks terrible, but we're going to get a planning committee around this. We're going to develop a course of treatment. We'll go back to you in 3 or 4 months and tell you what we're going to do. Meanwhile, you're saying, deal with this injury right now. I'm not leaving the office till my bleeding stops. Let's feel that urgency, and let's hear some things that this community can do to support our students and our community in a more immediate way.
So when it comes to an immediate action, I do believe that making communities and planning is an important thing. But before we get into that, I think a big thing is that you, or everyone here, like, you've heard what we had to say, and we appreciate you listening to us. And I feel like my fellow panelists will agree with that. But it's not just enough to hear and listen to what we have to say, but it's to take that to your heart. And I believe you to focus on what we're saying, how that interacts with what you value and what your beliefs are. Because if you value and believe what we say and believe that there needs to be a change for, like, and push for social justice and a pressuring, like, of these injustices that go on, that's going to transfer to your feet and you're going to go out and do something about it. However, if there's somewhere along the way that line breaks, like, and maybe I'm going to be bold and say that there are people who are listening in who don't feel the same way that many of us feel. I challenge you right now to examine what you value, what you believe, and to really examine that on your heart. And maybe, like, it's a change in heart that needs to occur right now with many communities. I'm not sure what it is, but I think changing on what you believe and then be able to have that passion to carry out the social justice and participating in these groups is what needs to occur now in the people.
I would say that something that could happen immediately is definitely try and understand what it means to be an ally. Educate your colleagues and your peers about what that actually means, and pledging your support. So one of the things that we are doing is a campaign to make sure that the university knows that we're serious and that our allies are supporting us. So if you could send an email to President Schill or to the Board of Trustees and let them know, hey, I heard what is going on with black students on our campus, and I want to know what you're doing to combat the anti-black racism, and what can we do moving forward as an institution. So I think that's something that could immediately be taken into account.
Also, come and visit the University of Oregon more often. Come and have conversations with us. We do have a multicultural center, even though it's like a little square that is maybe like only this space right here. But there are students there. The students hang out there. Come and have conversations with us. Come and ask us, what are you going through? How do you need support? We have a lot of things to say. We just need to be asked to share.
And just to piggyback off of what Shanice suggested, you know, it's Friday, it's the weekend, so I think one easy thing y'all could do is to, you know, if you felt something in this interaction so far and you have a sense of wanting to do something about it, I think you could take this weekend to consider writing a letter, like Shani said, or an email to President Schill and the Board of Trustees. I think you all, as a group of people, could even mobilize within yourself to schedule to go to the Board of Trustees whenever their next meeting is and show up and just simply say, hey, we had this panel, and this is how we feel, this is what we think about it, and we would like to stand in solidarity with these students and show support that, sorry, I'm getting so distracted, and show support that they have immediate needs and that we want to help move those needs forward, whether it's through funding and or just giving us space. I think that's a really easy thing y'all could do. So email and then show up to the Board of Trustees and schedule to meet with President Schill I'm sure we'll sit down with y'all and just tell them that you care. And then we know what we need, and we just need people to kind of give us that space. So I think forming that relationship could be helpful.
All right. Thank you. Today's topic is The Neglected Few, Students of Color and Their Experience on the UL Campus. Our speakers today are Perla Alavez, Dante Herrera, Shanice Curry, and Gerald Jacobosi. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.